linoleum knife. Look, I know I bought that for you. I know that it was a part of your astoundingly well-curated Christmas stocking. Vintage Barbara Streisand cassette. Wow. Simply wow. Barbara.
No, Simply Streisand.
Simply Streisand.
Simply.
Whatever.
There's like there's so much simple about that woman.
I know it's that all. I did that for you. Don't do it to me. That's what I'm trying to say.
You're not a Barbara fan.
You bought me the cassette. I thought cassette equals it needs to be on the show.
It does.
Welcome to the final.
No, I do like her. Actually,
welcome, no. Welcome.
I was just being
welcome. Yes,
just being goofy.
Hush your lips. Welcome to the final Linoleum Knife of 2013, and the first to feature our brand new mixing board, which I'm very excited about.
Hello, new mixing board.
Welcome.
I understand you even less than the old mixing board. This is Linoleum Knife. This is a podcast about movies, a podcast of the cinema.
Oui.
I'm Dave White. I'm the film critic for movies.com.
I'm Alonzo Duralde. I'm the film critic for therap.com and What the Flick.
We have a guest.
We do.
Our guest is one of my favorite guests. One of the few people who has come back more than once.
That's right.
And I was just saying earlier, you may be, so far actually you're the only person besides Bibbs and Gray.
And Gray.
Who've come back. And Bibbs and Gray don't count.
No. They're
Bibbs and Gray are just
they're
like,
practically cousins.
Yeah.
Just Bibbs and Gray. Just
there are,
about,
yeah,
Bibbs
there
and
are,
Gray.
There are kiss, there are kissing cousins. Yeah. And so they're around all the time. They're just sort of, they're sitting on the couch right now. Watching,
bound and gagged and
observing,
not allowed to talk.
Yeah. Drew Droege, who was our guest, our second guest, is one of my favorite guests because he always has something to say. We sometimes have guests that don't say anything much.
Yeah, even critics.
Even critics who are trying to be nice or diplomatic. And I love all Mark. I love all our guests. But some of y'all are more equal than others.
Now, I'm sure I've lost many jobs with my public opinions about things. I'll be like, I hated that, or I loved that. I don't know. You can't live in the middle about things. There are a few things I have zero opinion about.
No.
But I'm very passionate about movies, and I rarely leave a movie and go, eh. Or sometimes I do, and then like a day or so later, it'll percolate, and I go, this is why I didn't like it. Or sometimes I go, you know what, I like that more.
I get a sinking feeling when I walk out of a film that I have to write about.
Uh-huh.
If my feeling is,
It's hard to go 800 words.
It happens sometimes.
Yes. Oh, I don't know how you guys do that because there are some movies that I'm like, let's just pretend we didn't watch that. I didn't really,
It happens sometimes, and it's not fun at all to go home and sit and try to write something about it when you could not care.
Right.
One damn less than you do.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So, yeah. So, we appreciate Drew Droege, working actor, potentially offending future hirers.
Exactly.
By telling it like it T.I. is.
You're in luck on that regard, though, because no one important listens to this show.
Okay.
That's
okay,
a plus, yes. It's like basically you whispered it into a bottle and threw it in the ocean.
Okay. That's how I feel most of the time that I talk, so it's all good.
Now, by the way, Drew, of course, internet superstar, known for his YouTube videos.
Explain who our guest is.
You've seen him pretending to be Susanna Hoffs on, what was that show?
Up All Night.
Up All Night. You, of course, know him from the Chloe videos from YouTube. If you have not seen the Tanya Roberts for Tahiti Village video, press stop now and go watch that and come back.
Yes.
Pack a lunch. You need to see that.
Do you know who I realized that over the holidays that I was actually doing? I'm not really doing Tanya Roberts. I think I'm doing Rachel Ray. Like, I haven't watched Rachel Ray on anything in so long. And over the holidays, she was on. My mom had her on. And just the way it was, everything she was saying was just so emphatic. And it had that same candor. And it was just so much. It was just like, what is happening? Why is this an appealing presence in the morning around food?
There's absolutely nothing about
America's
her.
Syndicated sweetheart.
Gosh.
I watch all the cooking shows, not hers.
No, she's really like obnoxious to me.
She's abrasive, yeah.
Yeah, like and cloying and just you can just tell like a nasty person. I just get a vibe from them, like, oh, I don't want to be in a room alone with you. You're terrifying.
Now, Drew, I was just reading in this extensive interview that you gave to Frontiers Magazine that we have posted on the Linoleum Knife page on Facebook.
Oh, thanks.
That Glitter in the Garbage is coming back?
It is. I'm making it happen. I'm just putting it out there and saying I'm going to bring it back because I missed it. It was 2 years down that I can't believe. I did it for a year, and then I was like, I'm going to bring it back. I'm going to take some time off, and then 2 years went by. But I miss it, and it's a thing that I think about a lot, and it's like, what do I really want to be doing right now? And it's like, oh, I really want to be doing that show again.
It's an improv podcast, which I know sounds like a horror show, but when Drew does it, it's really funny. I still find myself quoting things about it all the time. Your whole the whole thing about how every time I'm in Culver City and I get lost, I think of the entire sketch you did about how it was laid out and how
they're brainchild of James Adomian, who you guys should have on the show as well. If you know James, but he's so great. It was his idea to do a whole sketch about a town hall meeting in Culver City, and the mayor was missing. They just couldn't find the mayor because it was so confusing to find anywhere in Culver City.
There are still public works employees starving to death by an underpass. Because
they were dead. We were crawling over dead people. And it was really hilarious. People just stopped. They just couldn't get to food. They just died.
There's a minotaur wandering around Culver City. Boy. So we had Drew on this week, A, because we love him as a guest, but B, because he was a very vocal defender of August Osage County on Facebook, and I was like, oh, you got to come in and talk about this, because it didn't work for me, but I've never seen the play. You are much more versed in this, so you start.
I loved it. Okay, I did see the play. I saw the play twice, and just saw it in New York, and then I saw it in L.A., and it...
Give a little plot background.
Okay, of the play?
Yeah.
Okay, so goes around the Weston family, which is a family of mom and dad. Dad is a unrepentant drunk. Mom pops pills. They get into a huge fight in the very beginning of the scene. I mean, the very beginning of the play, and then dad goes missing. And so then the whole family gets together to sort of, you know, figure out what happened, and it goes from there. And every character is addicted to one thing or another, and you find out that some people are sleeping with each other, and there's lots of family secrets and things uncovered. And I saw a clip of it at the Tonys when it won all the Tony Awards, and I just was like, I need to go to New York right now and see this immediately. So I went and saw a bunch of things at that trip, but I went and had such a crazy out-of-body experience when I saw the play. The play is wickedly funny. Which the film is not, but I thought that I've never had such a feeling in after that second act, when the blackout of the second act, when I was laughing and crying and clapping and talking to strangers and going, oh my god, oh my god. So then I went and saw it again, saw the tour again, and it was a whole different experience. It was a totally different cast, but it was the same production, and it was great. So then I saw the trailer for the movie, and I was like, oh, this is horrible. The trailer is fried green tomatoes. It's just not going to be... It's awful. So I was really surprised how much I love the film, because I was expecting to hate it. I thought it was as good a film of that play as you could make. Like, it's not as good as the play. But I thought
I heard that he chopped like an hour and a half.
He did. Out of the play. He did.
What's not in the movie?
I can't remember. There's definitely a scene between Barbara, the oldest daughter, who Julia Roberts plays in the film, and Ewan McGregor's character, her husband, Bill, where they're setting up the bed that night. I don't want to give away too many spoilers before they... But they have a scene between each other that I think they combined in the scene where they go out to grab the chairs for the... there's a scene with the landlady. Not the landlady. I'm adding characters. The maid, the housekeeper, and the daughter smoking pot together in the play.
Yeah, because the housekeeper is barely
in the film.
Yeah, they cast Misty Upham from Frozen River, who's great, and then she has like three scenes and no
words.
So
little to do. And she's a much bigger part of the play. And so she and the daughter have a scene together. And then that's really all I remember, other than, like, I think there were some scenes that were longer. You also, it was the play was 3 hours with two intermissions, so I don't think they cut in a, like an hour and a half out as much as they probably cut a good 40 minutes out.
Okay. See, my deal with this thing, I went in cold. All I knew was, you know, dark comedy, you know, very acclaimed. First of all, it felt like it's directed by John Wells, who's mainly known for TV. This is only his second feature. I don't feel like he took advantage of the space very well. Like, it's fine if you have a play that's mostly about a family gathering together for a crisis. Of course it's going to be inside the house. You don't want to open it up ridiculously. But then use that to your advantage and do something with it. You know, we were talking about the adaptation. I was like, why didn't they let William Friedkin direct it? Because not only did he do
a fantastic job with Killer Joe
and Bug, the two previous Letts movies, right. But also if you go back and look at like the Anniversary Party and Boys in the Band, he knows how to take these claustrophobic theater pieces and turn them into claustrophobic film pieces. So,
right.
You know, there's that. And then also I felt like Meryl Streep and Julia Roberts, nobody was telling them to dial it down. They were just off on a tear, and it was, you know, giant kaiju battle. You know, it didn't.
I read your review. Godzilla
versus Megalon. Yeah, I love Margot Martindale. I always loved Margot Martindale.
She's always
amazing. But really I just wonderful. And then it was like it was funny at times, and then not funny, and then it got uncomfortably like in the last scene of the film. There are either direct quotes or indirect references, intentional or not, to both Mommy Dearest and Valley of the Dolls.
Really?
Yeah. Because you said Julia Roberts plays Barbara, and when she screeches off in the car, Meryl Streep literally runs to the window and yells, "Barbara, please." And I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. And then this other thing happens that's right out of Valley, and I'm like, are you kidding me, movie? What is going on here? So I was never not entertained, but yes. I just thought, this movie is not the play that won a gajillion Tonys.
No, but I think, too, after seeing the play, you get such an attachment to who those people are. And I saw Estelle Parsons and Amy Morton do it on Broadway.
Oh.
And then Estelle Parsons again in L.A. with a woman named Shannon Cochran, who was equally brilliant in a totally different way. But I was so prepared to hate Meryl Streep and Julia Roberts in the movie because they were so miscast to me in my head about how they should have been.
Mm.
That I was really blown away by, I loved how big they were. I loved how insane, and I totally agree with you. But I am like eating it up. Like I was like, yes, just dig into each other, do it. And I, you know, but there is something about the film that is really not funny. That in the play, when an audience is there, and an audience is ooing and aahing and going, oh my god, and laughing, that inherently make the play a lot funnier.
Mm.
And yes, on stage, that set, that three-story set, and you're watching things happen on all floors, and you really are in that house, you know? And so I do think that they had a hard job with that. I think I just was so poised to hate it, but I, you know, and I shared it with my family in South Carolina, and I was expecting that they would be like, oh, you know, this is awful, and this is, and they all loved, they were all like, I know someone exactly like that, so and so, that is your, you know, and it's like, wow, so I you know, I think that there are, and I think given the just the abuse, especially Julia Roberts to me, that she was so miscast in my mind, and I was so expecting that this, like, movie star to come in and act it for me, and I was really I thought she was tough, I thought she was smart, I thought she was nasty and awful. And
well, yeah, no, she doesn't nice it up. I'll definitely do that. Now, Dave, sure. You liked it more than I did.
Everybody do what I say.
Yes,
everybody do what I say.
So great.
That is my favorite line in the film. It is said by my favorite lady, Julia Roberts.
Yeah.
I prefer her to Streep in this film because she's not unhinged. She's just seething through the entire thing, and no one will behave and do what they're supposed to be doing.
Right.
And so when
she's a mess too, though.
Oh, completely.
Yes, she is. But I feel as though her character is a mess because everyone really won't do what she says. I believe that if everyone would do what she says,
they'd all be happy.
It would all be good. Yeah. Like, I.
But don't you see her starting to become her mother at the end? Like, she becomes Streep at the end. I mean, her.
Her relationship with her daughter. And
unfortunately.
The way she starts throwing things around. Like, she says these sayings that are just like, you know, like about the world. And this is, there's no, you know. She says something as she's going into the house that just sounds exactly like, you know, a woman doesn't get prettier, she ages. Just one of those, just
right.
One of those. Hmm. Horrible throwaways.
Where I'm about to take this may become like spoilery for some people who haven't seen the film. I don't know, but I need to know for my own well-being. So in 10 seconds after I finish this sentence, we are going to talk about the very last couple of scenes. If you don't want to hear what those are, turn it down. Turn down your podcast now in 5, 4, 3, and we're going to do this for about 15 seconds, 2, 1, turn it down. All right. Does the play end with Streep?
Yes.
Or Roberts?
It ends with Streep.
That's what I thought.
Yes.
Because I haven't seen the play, but the film ends with Streep, and you think that's the end.
That was 15 seconds, and we're still talking about it. Give us another 30.
I will not spoil anything. What I am bothered by then, only really, aside from I believe you're right about not using the physical space very well, that final scene as it exists in the movie feels a little hopeful to me. And a little like, I'm free, you know, like, uh-huh. And I was annoyed by that. Having said that very sort of oblique thing, which...
Time's up.
We're done spoiling.
Yes.
I really dug the level of meanness that was going on. Now, it's not as sadistic and cruel and batshit crazy as Bug.
And Killer Joe.
Or Killer Joe.
Right.
Because I really dig Tracy Letts.
Me too.
Boy, do I dig
Me
him.
Too.
Like, he gets into Southern insanity in a way... that is only matched by my actual extended family.
Yes.
And
he's a good actor now, as it turns
he's
out.
He's a fantastic actor. I saw him on...
Did you see the Virginia Woolf?
No, I saw him in Betrayal with Amy Morton.
Oh, wow.
In Steppenwolf in Chicago. He's an amazing talent.
I've just seen him on Homeland this season.
Oh, right. Right. Yeah.
So I love the meanness.
Me too.
I really love the meanness of this movie. Not because I love mean people, obviously... But to watch, just to listen to Streep and Roberts and Margot Martindale, who's fantastic in the movie, but who is just as horrible
as
everyone else.
Oh, yeah.
Created in me a sense of underdistance because I was just joking about my extended family, but I'm not joking about my extended family because that's how they are. I've got people in my family... who have been feuding and fussing for decades.
Yeah, me too.
And who will not speak to one another, and who are now, like, fixing to be old and dead and still won't speak to one another.
Uh-huh.
And they're all just going to pass away, possibly alone in a trailer somewhere, and it might be weeks before the body is found, and it won't be by me because I live far, far away. And I have resigned myself to the fact that none of that extended family is actually going to inform me about what will about the fact that they did find the body.
No.
Like, these old people in my family will pass away and no one will tell me about it because they all hate each other so much.
Well, and there's also just this sense of...
So this is a great movie in terms of that. It's like a documentary, really.
Yeah, no, I feel like everyone sees
it's just not
family.
A good... It's just not a particularly well-made film. I think it's like well-acted.
I would agree with that.
In a crazy, big performance kind of way.
I feel like, to me, I know some people like that. There's something in the South, too, where everyone has these expressions, and you don't know... I mean, it is that thing where, you know, the butter done slid off her grits, or this and that, and it's like, you know, and some you don't even know what that means, and everyone says them, and everyone thinks. I mean, I thought it's brilliant to start with quoting T.S. Eliot, and actually, these people in this film and play are all smart, And right. that's what makes it really awful.
They're meant to be kind of a literary idiots. Family.
They are
yeah.
smart people. Yeah. And they are mean. And they're drug addicts. And they're horrible human beings. And so, but everyone has that sort of thing where everyone's sassy in the South and has a thing. They come back. I was right. just home with my family. Totally did. But my brother and mother-in-law got into it. And my brother said something. And my mother-in-law goes, well, I disagree. And my brother goes, well, of course you do. And she goes, I know, we disagree on everything. That's our thing. And my brother said, well, we need a new thing. And it's like, that's such a, like, and it was just, everyone threw it away. And it's like, wow. That's just how people talk. So I feel like that resonates for me in that play. It's like the people just, and it was so quick. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't said at all. And it's this level of, I mean, it's the opposite of, you know, to look at a movie like Nebraska, where there's so much unsaid and it's right. so quiet. And the Midwest is just this dead, you know, sort of flatland of just like there's so much under the surface. Whereas they put it out there. They put it all on the plate. They eat it up. They throw it up at each other, you know, and then talk about it for years.
Although this is, you know, it's Oklahoma technically. So it's right. It's somewhere between the South and Nebraska.
It is. It's more, yeah. Well, it's, you know, yeah, it's closer to Texas. Than,
right.
Yeah. For sure.
No, I was not bored by this
Oklahoma
movie.
Oklahoma is just north Texas.
Yeah. I was entertained by this movie, but I just came away from it thinking, this can't be the play that everybody was raving about. Like, yeah. if it started life as this, we wouldn't be talking about this.
No, I think so, yeah. And I think it just depends on your level of expectations. And I agree with you. I think it's a film of great performances more than...
Although there are some clunkers. Ewan McGregor.
Poor Ewan McGregor.
Except
I thought he was kind of great.
Oh, God. Except for I Love You, Philip Morris. I feel like when he plays American, he just, like, strips any interest he's got.
It's like the Japanese people in 47 Ronin.
I was the first time I ever saw that character as really the complete just creep that he was. In the play, I felt more sympathy for him. And in this movie, I was like, gosh, you're terrible. Like, when there's a big reveal at the table. It's so hard to talk about this movie without revealing things. But when there's a big reveal at the table, and Meryl just straight up asks him. And then Julia goes, can we not? And then Ewan McGregor just steps over and goes, yes, it's true.
Right.
And it was a moment of just like, oh, wow. To do that to your daughter and to your wife in front of your family, ew. And it's a hard part because it's just so much less showy than any right. other women.
I don't know. I felt like he was sort of lacking in any kind of charisma. And Benedict Cumberbatch.
Oh, really?
I thought like there must be 10 scenes on the floor somewhere because there's no way he would have signed on for this to do this little.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel you're like there is right maybe that. More in the play of him. Of
like he is more of a function of the plot than an actual character, I kind of felt like.
Yeah.
So, I like Julia Lewis.
Julia Lewis, she's always our favorite Scientologist.
The world's best Scientologist.
Yeah, she was fun.
Chris
Cooper was terrific. Dermot Mulroney, actually, I thought was kind of fun and sleazy.
Really great.
There are things it is worth, you know, checking out if it seems like it would be remotely appealing to you, but lower those expectations, I think, is the watchword here. Big movie this week that everyone has been talking about is, of course, Martin Scorsese's Wolf of Wall Street.
And I have written an open letter to everyone in the world. Here is my open letter. I did not understand this film. Therefore, it should not exist, and shame on everyone!
You're talking about that woman, the daughter.
Talking about every damn person on the internet I have heard in the week. Not just that open letter, but I'm overhearing conversations about it wherever I go. Last night, I was at the Egyptian with my friend Shannon. We were seeing the Poseidon Adventure, and people just talking about Wolf of Wall Street in line. And like, did you see that open letter? Well, you know, I agree. And I'm like, you're stupid.
You're stupid if you agree with that open letter. That open letter infuriated me. And it's,
that poor woman who grew up and was completely destroyed by her own father and his cronies.
Absolutely.
I have nothing but sympathy for the terrible life that befell her through no fault of her own.
Right.
She does not understand this film.
She doesn't. And we are...
Which is weird to say, because it happened kind of to her.
Yeah. But that's she's not understanding what Scorsese's
intent. The movie's not about
this. No. As somebody tweeted recently, it's like when Jonathan Demme said, "Let me make this clear. I totally support men making suits out of women's skin."
Yeah, exactly. I know. Or like if you look at any Scorsese film, I mean, aside from maybe what, Hugo? Yeah. Like what Scorsese film like basically endorses the behavior that happens in it? Like
Alice doesn't live here anymore and Kundun.
Okay, there you go. Yes, exactly. There you go. It's like it's Scorsese, it's and if we are so dumb as to think that showing a certain behavior on screen is what's celebrating it, it's like I'm baffled. I'm completely baffled.
I think the people who aren't getting this movie in a way want the old production code back. You know, yes. Where like it was a very clear right and wrong, and like the evil was always punished, and you know, they want somebody to step on screen and say, you know, well, this is really terrible.
They should go see Saving Mr. Banks, a movie about a horrible woman that we're supposed to like and we're supposed to be in, you know, completely in bed with, who's a terrible, rotten human being that you know, and that movie that, you know, Disney, like, you know, makes her a good person or some complete crap. It's like, that's what they need to go see. Go see Saving Mr. Banks. You know, go talk to a wall for a minute. You know, it's like, you're an idiot. You know, I'm sorry. But, like, I didn't for a shred of the time think, oh, this is what this movie is.
No, Scorsese has all along been sort of fascinated by male bad behavior.
Yes.
And the male bad behavior that leads to success in certain areas, be it war or crime or finance.
Right.
There's a lot about this movie I love. I don't think it's a perfect film. I think I can tell that they rushed it into theaters. Like, they had to make that December 25th opening date. And I bet if he and Thelma Schumacher had had another 6 months to edit this thing, it would have been shorter and more streamlined. And I don't notice these things. People have been talking about that there are a ton of shots that don't match, you know, where like
somebody was talking about that on Facebook too. I didn't notice that.
I don't catch that stuff. But on the plus side, I think it's maybe the best Leonardo DiCaprio performance.
Absolutely.
Ever.
Oh, yeah. Fantastic.
Certainly tremendous. His first funny one.
The Quaalude scene will go down in history.
Oh my God. That's,
will go down in film history as one of the funniest sequences in any movie.
It's amazing.
You know? It's masterful. It's Chaplin.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, the most recent example of anything like that I could think of was Steve Martin in All of Me.
Yes.
Of somebody
exactly.
Pretending that they cannot control their own motor functions.
Absolutely. That's great. Yeah. I my jaw was on the floor. And Jonah Hill equally gave to me a towering performance as that. I thought he was so great. And I just, I had so much fun in Wolf of Wall Street. Yeah, it should have been shorter. And yeah, you know, there's stuff that's repetitive and there's some pacing issues and stuff. And I don't think it's a perfect movie either. But I thought it was so much fun. It was just a thrill ride of just horrible behavior.
Yeah, it is a movie that is about how what's happened to this country over the last 30 years. But without sort of telling you that that's what it's about.
Yes.
And without sort of punishing the people involved, because guess what? None of them ever get punished.
Yeah.
You know, right. And you look at all the people on Wall Street who created the housing bubble, who you know, screwed over everybody and destroyed the world economy.
They got bonuses.
Yes.
Right.
That we
and
paid for.
These people in this movie are the people that idolize those people, too.
Right.
It's like the people that, you know.
That was aspirational. For
yes.
Them.
And so that is what the movie is saying too. It's like this is what when they gave those heart to heart speeches and the woman, that brilliant woman, who was she? The blonde, where
the employee,
the employee.
Oh yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
That whole moment where she's just and it's like they, it's like
she's
touching,
like, I love you.
Tender.
Yeah, yeah.
I love you so much. Kind of a speech, and it's just like, wow, this is unbelievable.
Yeah.
If the structure of this movie is an accident of not having enough time to edit, then I think it's a lucky accident, because I believe that the repetitive nature of the film is very much like the repetitive nature of Spring Breakers, in that you are simply caught in this like
constant
cyclone of
lather, rinse, repeat
of insanity. Yeah. And I really believe that the film is at this like high pitch of yelling and screaming and crazy horrible behavior in a way that sort of is intended to match the kind of ecstasy of certain mental illness.
Well, it's a cocaine movie.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
And so, it's like the final third of Goodfellas, but for the entire time.
If yes. greed is a mental illness, and it is, then that is what this film is about. It is about the sociopathic, mm-hmm. you know, ecstasy of being, you know, stuck in greed. And how the country that we live in celebrates it, even though it doesn't understand that it's celebrating sociopath behavior. Mm. So I think presentation in this context is its own critique. They were punished this teeny much.
Right.
As opposed to the people who came later who were not punished at all. Like we said, they got bonuses.
Right.
And so it is about the decline of American life. It is not celebrating the decline of American life.
It's in a way, it would be an interesting pairing with The Act of Killing, which is this documentary where they found the people who were mainly responsible for the Indonesian genocide of the 60s and basically let them make a film telling it from their perspective, and they sort of present themselves as these sort of dashing gangster movie type heroes and stuff. And at one point, they get interviewed on a, like, you know, state-run television talk show where they're welcomed as heroes and cheered for their great work of, you know, getting rid of the communists or whatever. And it's that same creepy disconnect between, like, you know, socially endorsed but nightmarishly awful behavior that I think you're getting from this film, too.
It's just like a Nazi propaganda film or any of those, you know, those sort of things where you're like, oh, this is just this saying... Yeah, that is really.
I really want to see it again. That's how much I love it.
I do too.
I love it too. I thought it was.
And I think it's just magnificent. Like, it's one of Scorsese's very best films.
I'm not going to go there with you. I think
I believe it is.
I still think it's a flawed film, but it is an interesting one, and it is one I would like to see again. I'd rather see American Hustle again first, though.
Well, yeah. I do like American Hustle.
That was fun. I thought American Hustle was fun. I thought Wolf of Wall Street was a better film. I prefer it as a film, but I thought... I've seen American Hustle a couple times, and I like it more every time I see it. It's just, to me, was less of a... I wanted to like American Hustle more than I did, and I feel like it was like the style was so great. There were some fantastic performances, especially by the two leads in American Hustle, that I thought were just impeccable. It was just, like I said, it was a fun movie that I enjoyed all three times that I watched it. But
I think that one's extraordinary, and I think they take real narrative chances, and they pay off really mm-hmm. well. So I love that one. All right, moving on.
Walking with Dinosaurs.
Yes, which only you saw. Yeah, I didn't see it. And like literally in the entire country, I think only you saw, because it's dying out there.
I haven't heard of it. I've not even heard of this movie.
It's a strangely animated film in that really, really, really photorealistic backdrops, which in fact may be... actual photography.
Well, this was a BBC show, right? Walking with Dinosaurs.
That's my understanding. I never watched it.
That I think had a more educational bent to it.
Well, this has John Leguizamo as a sassy bird. And I don't think that's anybody's. Justin Long is the voice of a baby dinosaur who says things like this: "Not everyone eats puked up leaves."
Education.
And then you can see his mom pre-chewing and pre-saliva-ing the food for him, and he eats
what?
It. And, yeah.
I'm sorry, if I want to go see Walking with Dinosaurs, I don't want to watch like a bird chew up its food and spit it to its baby. I don't want to watch that. That's as much as
we'll get to the Walking Dinosaurs in a moment, but first
we have to masticate.
First regurgitation.
It isn't much about anything except actual walking
breakfast
alongside dinosaurs and migrations and dino battles with other dinos and John Leguizamo as the sassy bird and
should have been funny
like a pterodactyl, or is he just like a parakeet?
He's like a T toucan or something. I don't know what he is. It's like, he's some bird.
It should have been Mind Walking with Dinosaurs, and they would have been voiced by Liv Ullmann and Sam Waterston and talk about philosophy.
Is it a touch of the hero's journey thing going on?
Oh, you don't say.
Patchy has to grow up and become the leader of the herd and, you know, find the inner strength in himself and the stuff. And the,
that's great.
I was alone in the theater at the Grove watching it. Alone. So I was very happy to text you during the entire film.
I always enjoy those.
I always get a secret thrill out of watching a film alone in anywhere, because that means I can be the horrible person who turns their phone on and texts.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You called me from one of the Larry the Cable Guy movies.
Oh, yeah.
We had a conversation.
I took a picture of the screen at Larry the Cable Guy Health Inspector and sent it to you. Yeah.
I saw Sparkle like that. The
Jordan Sparks.
Jordan Sparks. One, I saw Sparkle by myself. And was screaming back at the time. And then I just got up and left. I got so fed up with it, I just walked out. When I never walk out of movies.
The most
terrible. Sadly, you guys were doing this for work, and I was just doing it because I had Tuesday afternoon. I'll go see Sparkle by myself.
I think that's more sad.
It's way more sad.
This otherwise completely bland and not much of anything kind of kid film looks great because you've got, you know, really highly detailed animated dinosaurs against these what appear to be real photographic backdrops, and it looks like they're really interacting with it. I mean, it's like, it's beautiful looking.
Right.
It's really great to look at. Didn't Devin say he was going to go and wear his headphones?
Yes, and he was asking for what music should listen I listen to
music?
To?
Wow. Yeah.
Eat it. You know, a couple, you know, mushroom caps.
Well, enjoy your life. I think when Todd Gilchrist reviewed this for The Wrap, and he pointed out, remember the Disney movie Dinosaur?
Yes, didn't it was one a thing of our that happened.
Yes,
work
was,
on
animated
that.
It, and he said it's the same thing. Where like that movie had gorgeous dinosaurs and beautiful, you know, visuals, and then the script was just rotten.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And that's what
this
we get
one is actually more than rotten in that. You have a subplot, a romantic subplot about Patchy and his girlfriend, who she...
His name is Patchy?
His name is Patchy.
Okay. Yeah.
She has, I think, what could only be described as a negative amount of agency in this film. Like, she is genuinely traded back and forth between herd leaders.
Oh, boy.
And she goes along with this, like, those are the rules of the dinosaur. I guess I just get traded back and forth. And you know, they're making a point about wanting Patchy more than anything else. But, you know, and you're meant to think it's sad that she's being traded back and forth. But she's being traded back and forth. Woman.
Wow.
That's what happens to you.
Oh, brother.
Until, yeah, it's, I...
You need to write an open letter.
Yeah, I'm going to write an open letter.
To evolution. The other movie that only you saw was 47 Ronin. Not 46, not 48. 47 Ronin.
Compared to Walking with Dinosaurs, 47 Ronin is kind of maybe worth looking at. But only for Rinko Kikuchi.
Well,
I love her.
And she is a sorceress, demon, wolf, dragon.
Oh, I'm in.
Okay.
I'm on board.
And sometimes her hair becomes chopsticks.
Oh.
Yeah. Which, like two giant chopsticks or a lot of little ones? Like the very large chopsticks attempting to feed you, you know, tongues and things, you know, like, yeah.
But just two, her just, whole just, head of hair turns into two chopsticks.
Two big chopsticks.
Big chopsticks, okay. Yeah. Everything else is terrible and unfortunate and sad. Like, the list of things that are wrong with this movie is too long for me to... There are more
and
than
what
40,
does 47 Ronin mean? Is
more
like
than 47
84
of
Charing Cross? Like, what
yes.
is it? Is it? It's an address?
It's
or?
About Keanu Reeves in a long-distance correspondence with his favorite bookseller.
What?
At 47 Ronin Road. And...
You're kidding.
He is.
And, okay, I was going to say.
Ronan, as the film goes out of its way to define for
they
you several
the
times.
They become the best of friends.
Are a masterless
over
samurai.
First editions of Peep's Diary.
And, it sounds riveting.
I'd see that movie.
Yeah. I did see that movie. I saw both of those movies. He's a part of a team of Ronin who have been, you know, they've been disgraced. That's why they're Ronin. And
a Ronin is a type of samurai.
Yeah. Without a samurai without a master.
I see.
Oh, wait, this movie was made for you.
Oh, I can't wait to see that.
Because every Japanese term in the film is defined in English, even when two Japanese people are talking to each other.
Oh, great. Okay, good. That's important.
Now you are to commit seppuku, death by one's own hand.
Okay, good. Oh.
Now you are Ronin, masterless samurai.
Yeah, he's Japanese!
Sayonara.
That's what you're saying!
Sayonara. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Yeah. It is unbelievable.
Chopsticks.
Worst of all,
Ray,
these
a drop
poor
of gold
Japanese actors. These poor Japanese actors are none of whom speak English as a first language, except perhaps Getty Watanabe.
Right.
Oh yes, he definitely.
He's in a very small role.
And Corey, what's his face?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And but everyone else, they speak Japanese first, English second, and so. The emphasis is often on the wrong syllable,
uh-huh.
And you are wishing that they weren't having to do this to themselves. It would have just been easier to have Keanu Reeves speaking Japanese because he is a post anyway.
In any language.
He might be brilliant in Japanese.
Maybe he is.
He might be a brilliant actor.
I am told that they shot this in both languages.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Side by side.
And they tested it?
Shot for shot, and apparently the Japanese language version is happening in Japan.
Right.
But apparently even there, they're not buying it because it's so fantastical.
Well, I'm sure. If they're having
it,
everything explained to them, I'm sure it's just sort of like, well, thank you.
Just
no, thank
a
you.
Total... It is so dumb and so low stakes and so not about anything urgent. You know, you've got this, it's about like defending honor and dying for a principle. And
okay.
You sit through the whole thing going, all right, I guess there's going to be another samurai battle here and y'all are going to die for your
principles.
Your principles. And I should be excited about that.
Right.
Like,
right.
My DVD picks of this week are four Bruce Lee movies that I'm going to watch all week long on my time off. Which have nothing to do with samurai or Ronin. They're just Chinese, you know, martial arts movies. But here's the thing about those films. Movies where Asian people are fighting, okay? The overall blanket of movies where Asian people are fighting.
Joy Luck Club.
They're exciting. Yes.
Best quality crab.
They are in some way exciting. They feel urgent. They feel like something's at stake. And there's nothing at stake here.
Mm.
But Rinko Kikuchi turns into a dragon and a wolf and a chopstick haired lady.
I love her in films where she does not speak.
Yeah.
Like, she's brilliant in The Brothers Bloom, but does not speak at all.
Oh, right.
And I didn't see Babel, but I hear she's good in
you
that,
You didn't see
too.
Babel?
No.
Oh, wow.
I wasn't reviewing
her bit
she's
in Babel.
She's fantastic in Babel.
Is great.
Yeah.
Her chunk of Babel is really
arguably
great.
The best thing in the whole movie.
Because it's a rotten movie other than her chunk.
Right.
Yeah.
Domo arigato, Mr. Keanu.
So anyway, this one, Keanu Reeves plays an outcast who's a... they keep calling him half-breed through the movie. And
that's all I ever heard.
Yeah, exactly. And they say it so many times, it's like, you know, Candyman and Beetlejuice. You know?
Drinking game.
He teams up with the Ronin to fight the evil warlord who killed their master.
Mm.
And that's what happens in 47 Ronin.
I can't wait to then rush right out.
You keep waiting for George Carlin in a phone booth to show up.
Don't go see 47 Ronin. You'll be very sad.
Youch. Yeah. Okay.
And it makes me sad because I like a good samurai movie. I love samurai movies. I love samurai movies. If you had one every week, I would be happy.
Speaking,
I like swords and stabbings and beheadings and
Sure.
Honor killings. Yeah. I love that stuff.
A movie that needed,
I do not love this.
A movie that needed more stabbings and beheadings was The Invisible Woman, the second film from director Ralph Fiennes, who also stars as Charles Dickens. It's about his affair with a younger actress played by Felicity Jones. This movie bored the snot out of me. What was your take? Yeah.
You know what? I was surprised how much I liked it, and because I had no interest in seeing it ahead of time. And
I didn't either.
Yeah.
Although I did like Coriolanus, the first film he directed.
Oh, right. I didn't see it.
It was really good.
No, I love Charles Dickens, and I love that world, and I thought that was a really interesting... I had no idea about the story. I thought the woman who played his wife was fantastic.
She was good. I don't know her name, but I liked Tom Hollander as Wilkie Collins.
Yes,
he seemed kind of alive in a way that a lot of the people in the film weren't.
You know, I thought it was interesting. I didn't love it. I'm not going to argue why it was incredible. But I was really like, oh wow, I never would have seen that had I not, gotten a screening of it. And I thought it was interesting. You know, I saw it a few weeks ago, and I can't really tell you that I can remember much about it. Because I'm going, well, they were in love, and then they couldn't.
And then there's a train wreck. Yeah.
Right.
What's interesting about the film is that it really dwells on Dickens' life as an actor and as a celebrity. Mm-hmm. He was, you know, his stuff was serialized. It was very, he was a bestseller in his lifetime. Yeah. And he would do... I knew that he did readings of his own stuff that was very, very popular. I didn't know that he appeared on stage.
I didn't know any of that either. I thought that was really interesting.
So that was kind of cool. Their relationship never felt particularly vivid to me. I did kind of like Kristen Scott Thomas as Felicity Jones's mother. You know, she was interesting. But it just, overall, I don't know. I wasn't sure what I was supposed to leave having learned about all this. Except that, like, well, you know, you have an affair with a rich and powerful guy, you're probably going to get screwed over. You know?
Right, yeah.
Mankind should have been your business.
There you go. knowledge was the real treasure. It just kind of left me cold. I was a little disappointed just because I did like his first movie so much. But, whatever.
It's beautifully shot, and there's some really cool stuff. There is some cool stuff about the theater of the 19th century, which is... Arguably, it was a horrible century for theater. So it was interesting to watch really bad acting and really bad theater.
Lots of proscenium.
Proscenium and melodrama. And the sets were just incredible. The lengths that they would go to create such bad theater, which is kind of fascinating to me. Because it's like, I remember theater history in college, it was always like, we're going to skip the 19th century. It was Uncle Tom's Cabin, and that was about it. And then we'll move on. So that was, it's always interesting.
Yeah, if you go to movies just for the antimacassars, there will be plenty to keep you entertained.
I can't drink coffee if you're going to say antimacassars. Spit it all over your new mixing board.
Tons of period detail, to be sure.
Grudge match.
You know what? I didn't see that one.
Lucky you. It's sort of like, wow, you know.
It is a giant turd. This movie is a giant turd about two turds that fight in a turd match of turd fighting.
I would love it if it was really animated turds that were voiced by Robert De Niro and Sylvester Stallone. And they would beat each other up, like beating up turds. Like,
I think arguably they are the...
But also Kim Basinger, like just Kim Basinger acting against
Kim
two
Basinger
turds.
Kim Basinger acting...
Now you got a picture.
Still called Grudge Match.
If there are two actors who have been more complicit in sort of turding on their own reputation...
I agree.
It's De Niro and Stallone. And this feels like the final insult. You know, like, oh... Okay, you've made everything else ridiculous. Now Rocky and Raging Bull are gonna get stepped on. Like, there's nothing left that you won't.
How dare you?
You won't trudge on your own, past history, mm-hmm. And it's just embarrassing.
Stallone does it worse than De Niro does, because there's more. Because frankly, nobody saw Raging Bull.
True.
And everybody saw Rocky.
Right.
And so. There's a lot of visual stuff in Rocky to goof on that they do
Oh, they do?
He does the raw egg drinking and the meat punching.
And they basically say, well, that's just ridiculous and stupid. And you think, no, that was great. It was great when he beat up the raw meat and raw cheese. It was great when he drank the raw eggs. You're stupid and wrong for making fun of it now. Everyone sucks.
Why are we deconstructing and ruining everything that was great?
It's like when the Lone Ranger at the end of the movie says, "Hi, O Silver," and Tonto goes, "Never do that again." I was like, that's it. I'm out.
That's a terrible thing.
Stallone thinks everything should be the Expendables now. So when it's
all winky winky,
it's
all,
I would argue that Robert De Niro is worse just because he's actually a great actor and
he fell from a higher height. Yeah.
He just, like, when you watch him do these horrible comedies, like awful, and I would include Meet the Parents, which is just
those
an
are,
exercise.
Those Walker's movies are bad,
awful.
Bad,
even bad. The original one, awful. Yeah. And it's like, you know, you're watching these movies and you're just like, you are incredibly talented and you are phoning it in. You don't care.
No, he doesn't care.
Actually, the one movie this year where De Niro goofs on a role from the past and actually does...
He was great. American Hustle.
Well,
going to say that. He was great.
Yeah, but I was... That's okay. Sorry. Two then. Because, yeah, he is genuinely menacing and threatening in American Hustle. But as far as movies where he's having fun goofing on his screen persona, The Family is actually better than you'd think.
I didn't see that. Yeah.
It's, you know, sorry. It's not great, but look, next to Grudge Match, it's genius.
Well, I mean...
You know, at least that movie didn't leave me with the bad taste in my mouth that, oh, I can't believe De Niro's doing this to himself the way this one does. This one, you're just like, oh, God, just stop it. The only thing that I like in this movie, and I keep forgetting this guy's name, I'm going to look at the guy who plays the son, who's on Walking Dead, and he's in Wolf of Wall Street. He's the guy who gets arrested after fighting with Jonah Hill in the parking lot.
Oh.
Why can I never remember?
Oh, right.
Anyway,
he was so great. That guy was so good in Wolf of Wall Street.
Vamp, I'll come up with it in
Da 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 da. Two turds. Both aging.
Here's a special problem of this movie. The level of unironic gay panic going on in this film is
and trans panic
is crazy.
And,
yeah.
Why, like, would you even need to do that?
Like, you see a Judd Apatow comedy or a Kevin Smith movie, and there's
John Bernthal. Sorry,
okay.
There's a high degree of gay panic in both of those directors' films,
but the
joke is always on the straight guy.
Yeah,
the joke is on, oh, look at this dummy straight dude, you know,
being uncomfortable,
freaking out about gay stuff.
Exactly.
This is just straight guys freaking out about gay stuff.
This is like 1960s sort of like...
out of control.
Like, let's call the butch lesbian him, you know, kind of thing.
To the point where there's a scene where Stallone is being fitted for a suit by a tailor and gets all about the guy measuring his inseam. Like, stop touching my balls. You homosexual... men's suit tailor.
The first time we see Alan Arkin as Stallone's
old
manager.
I'm really upset. I guess I didn't get that part.
You were up for a homosexual tailor. The first time that we meet Alan Arkin as Stallone's old manager is in a nursing home complaining about the rough sponge baths that he gets from Anthony Anderson and how he's lingering too long or some shit.
What kind of man? The joke in the line Arkin has to say is, what kind of man takes a job where he's washing another man's balls or something like that? And
I turn.
I would love to say that to every hospice nurse.
Exactly.
They need to devote their lives to helping and saving lives.
I turned to Bibbs in that scene. And I said, Burgess Meredith was never so happy to be dead.
Right. Yeah. Oh boy. What a sad. Well, that's the thing. These people will die.
I take it back.
And it's like when they're their last films, you're like, oh, please, let's hope that no one watches this.
Yeah, exactly. No, but I do take it back. It's not turds. It's not as good as turds.
No,
turds are better.
Wow.
Yeah, no, in my review on The Wrap, I said that, you know, I said, go back and watch Rocky and Raging Bull, because as they say it at a closed casket funeral, it's better to remember them as they were.
I know.
Walter Mitty.
Yeah. Okay. Explain yourself.
We're in a little bit of a fight.
Yes.
About Walter Mitty. Because I think it's sweet and kind. sweet and kind and good-hearted.
I think it's phony and contrived and an advertisement for Ben Stiller and how awesome Ben Stiller is.
State your case.
All right, well, it's loosely based on the James Thurber story about a man who lives in his fantasies. This time around, Walter Mitty is a quiet guy who has spent much of his adult life taking care of his widowed mother, which meant putting aside his own dreams of teen skateboard championshipping.
That's right.
And so now, so he works in the photo department in Life, which is about
very important,
which is about to go all online. And world famous photographer played by Sean Penn sends in this image that he says is the quintessence of Life magazine, but it's missing, and Mitty can't find it. And so he in turn has to go on this round the world trek to track down Sean Penn and find the image and learn things about himself and unlock his inner bravery and it looks great. I will give you that. It's shot beautifully, although as I think Devin Faraci pointed out, it's a feature-length credit card commercial.
Well, the whole thing does feel so much like a commercial to me. I kept waiting to see something like Levi's. I've been drinking heavily. I was watching one big montage of awesome. And it's creepy to me to watch a movie that's directed by the star, and the star is so lionized and to look so cool.
And other people tell him how amazing he is.
Yeah, that smacks of Almost Famous to me, which is another movie that did that to me, which is, you know, I know a lot of people love that movie, but it's the same feeling of like, I'm just creeped out when you're telling me how great you are, like the whole time, and other people tell me how
like,
great
I mean,
you
all are. All the way to the final shot of the film where you're just like, oh God, stop taking a bow, Ben Stiller.
I thought it was filled with a lot of great supporting performances that I was way more interested in. I
felt like there were a lot of misused. Like, I love Adam Scott and I love Kristen Wiig, and I felt like both of them were not given. They were not. Well, Kristen Wiig was given little to do but be the girl, and Adam Scott was given this really badly written, kind of cartoony nemesis that could have been smarter and funnier and more interesting, and just felt very slapdash. I did like Patton Oswalt as the eHarmony customer support guy on the phone, which there is so much eHarmony and Cinnabon and Papa John's Pizza product placement in this movie.
I don't understand. And I almost feel like it was that sort of a joke or not.
I saw a TV ad for Walter Mitty that had an eHarmony like tag at the end of it. So, like, they're on board.
Oh, I don't really watch a lot of TV, when I was back home and with my family, there was a commercial for Walter Mitty on every other commercial. It was it's being advertised so heavily. So I'm wondering if a lot of people just bought ads within it or something. I don't know,
sometimes there are movies where they it's a paid arrangement. Sometimes it's just you're allowed to use the name, but they didn't pay to use. But this one, I think.
And also, how did it get a PG? That also is creepy to me. There's also something that smacks of like, I don't know how this happened. Live action movies don't get PG ratings anymore, and the MPAA is such a disgusting organization.
Right.
Well, yeah.
That I'm like, I wouldn't doubt if they were paid something as well.
Oh well, yeah. They've always shown favor towards like studio movies and movies about heterosexuality.
Absolutely. GBF gets an R,
and
Walter Mitty gets a PG.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, Wolf of Wall Street, I think if that had been an indie, would have been an NC-17.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
But yeah, so Walter Mitty, I just found, and the other thing that Devin Faraci said that I thought was interesting was that there's no, he compared it to Entourage in that there's no actual dramatic tension ever. Like, there's almost nothing driving this story forward. There's no, it's just this succession of events that unfolds, and I just didn't buy a lot of it. I was kind of bored, and I didn't buy the character sort of blossoming in the way that he does. He almost seems half forced into it, and then when it does happen, it all happens really fast, and he's just suddenly, you know, this superhero. It just didn't work for me.
Yeah, it reminded me a lot of Joe versus the Volcano, or it's one of those movies with it just felt big and silly in a way that I just had a hard time emotionally buying into any of it.
Dave, defend it.
Neither of you have swayed me one moment. Not one inch. Fine. Not one bit.
I wouldn't have expected we would have.
Huh. I do not like Ben Stiller. The actor. In those terrible Fockers movies. In those not quite as terrible Night at the Museum movies, but that are still pretty very terrible. Still very bad. And just...
I need to see Greenberg. I hear he's good in that.
Greenberg is really good.
I need to see that, too.
Because I love
Greenberg is great. But in general, I do not like him because I get this sort of gnawing, hungry, angry, upset vibe from him.
Oh, yeah.
The thing...
deeply angry.
The thing of... I work out too much and I'm upset about it.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
You know, like I get... That's how I feel. He just radiates this
but now,
rage.
Always or lately? Like going back
lately.
To, okay, because somebody else said that that this is the kind of movie that the Ben Stiller Show would have totally mocked.
Oh, I'm sure. The Ben Stiller Show was amazing. It was great.
But then, you know, I think about the films that he has directed.
Mm-hmm.
And I like them all.
I like Tropic Thunder.
I like Tropic Thunder. I like Zoolander. I like The Cable Guy. I like Reality Bites.
Mm.
I loved the Ben Stiller Show. And if I take all of those things together and then add this on top of it, it doesn't feel like a betrayal of those things. It feels like the film of a man who is growing older and might not be quite so full of rage anymore, or maybe is trying not to be so full of rage. This is a softer, sort of gentler version of him than what I've been getting, and it felt like a relief to me. On top of it, I feel like this movie is more in line, although not fully, with the original Thurber story, which is actually quite dark and very short. It's 5 pages long.
Right.
Than the Danny Kaye slapsticky kind of thing that happened.
Thurber hated the Danny Kaye version.
Yeah, because he...
probably would hate this one, too.
He might hate this one, too, because this one does come very close to that sort of, like, empowerment, self-esteem sort of garbage that I also can't stand.
Right.
But instead of getting big and outlandish and superhero-like, like you say, which is actually not what happens, mm-hmm. It happens in his fantasy at the beginning. It in spite of the fact that outlandish adventure is happening to him at the end of the film, in the second half of the film, he is staying somewhat small and becoming a part of it.
No. He swims with sharks and he skateboards across Iceland. That is super heroic.
I had a hard time separating what was fantasy and what was real. I could never tell. I was like, is he really traveling? Is he going in his mind? Is he doing those things?
The film is divided into two halves. The beginning, he's fantasizing, and then the actual adventure begins.
Once he hops on the helicopter, it's all real.
That was not at all clear
to
me.
And the real stuff is as outlandish, practically, as the fantasy stuff.
But in the fantasies, he is a big person. And in the second half of the film, he remains a small person interacting with this giant adventure.
But who still commits extraordinary acts.
It's not as important as how he is behaving within those extraordinary acts.
No, I'm sorry. I don't buy it.
It is sweet. It is good-hearted. It is not great. It's not a great movie. It is aesthetically, it looks really nice, like the credit card commercial, but it is aesthetically not ambitious. I'm giving you that. It's very copycat-ish of a lot of advertising that's happening right now. I understand that, and it's true. However, it's kind. And it is giving me a Ben Stiller that I can live with.
not to get into spoilers, but when the quintessential Life magazine image is revealed, did you not roll your eyes so hard they were going to fall out of your head?
No.
Then we have nothing to talk about. You're hopeless.
I wanted more Kristen Wiig and Adam Scott, and John Daly, and everybody else. And I just thought they all were so interesting, and I thought they were just lovely and really fleshed out parts of that they, you know, were given. And then I was sort of like, oh, okay,
more of this.
We get more of this running, graying man.
Lone Survivor.
Lone Survivor. Interesting that we were talking about with Wolf of Wall Street how people interpret a movie versus what a movie is actually saying.
Yeah.
Because I came away with this thinking, wow, what a bold anti-war statement.
Ooh, not me at all.
But then everything I'm reading is all like, oh, these brave men and their sacrifice. And I'm like, no, this is a movie about how war is pointless and ridiculous and a waste of time.
I felt like this movie was... if Sarah Palin directed Zero Dark Thirty.
Wow. Okay.
I loathe this Lone Survivor movie because I felt like the entire time I was watching a, you know, America F yeah, a whole time. I didn't get any sense of two sides. I got no sense of like that war is bad. I was just like, let's go and just kill these towel heads. Like, I thought it was, ugh, it made me sick.
So this is Peter Berg's follow-up to Battleship, and it's it is a very much ground's eye view of a real life U.S. Mission in Afghanistan that went terribly, terribly wrong. You know, the title is a spoiler. Mark Wahlberg's character is the only one who comes back alive. It's basically you've got these guys who are in the mountains. They're trying to assassinate a warlord who they think is in a village. Some goat herds stumble upon them, and they have to decide, well, either we kill them and keep our tracks covered, or we don't commit a war crime and then run the risk of them alerting everyone in the village that we're here. And they don't, and they do, and so, and then there's a battle sequence in the middle of this movie that I found very intense.
Oh, like, incredibly intense!
You know, like not since Saving Private Ryan. I don't think I've seen it. But just where just the sounds and the proximity and the cracking and the level of
human destruction.
And people falling off of cliffs. I mean, the stunt team of this movie deserves special praise.
God,
they do a lot of falling off of really things intense. And rolling down of hills.
I was terrified during the battle sequence, wondering, because a part of me, my head was out of it, part of me thinking, are these stunt guys getting hurt? I mean, like, are they
getting
hurt?
It's really...
because I don't see how this can happen. I don't see how I can be looking at this and a human being not actually being destroyed.
Right.
You know,
if you remember too, the Afghani deaths were just very quick, done and done. Mm-hmm. But all the beautiful, perfect white heroes that you're supposed to love and care about get thrown across rocks and cracking against trees and heads splitting open, and it's just so overwrought where you're just like, okay, all right, we get it. It's rough for them. I know that's based on a book. And that's the title of the book, whatever. But the title alone is like where you're just like sort of, you're just gonna, why am I watching this? Why watch this movie? Why tell this story? I don't understand why this man gets a movie made.
But then there's the whole second half of the film where basically he is rescued by Afghanis who basically, because of their own sort of laws and traditions about hospitality, not only take him in and tend to him, but save his life from other people who want to kill him. And so to me, that's why I came away with this thinking that it was an anti-war film, because here you have these guys who go to war against these people, and then it's these people that save this guy.
Right.
You know? I just felt like it was too little too late. Like, I was already so turned off, and I felt like you got no real... I didn't even get what you're adding in there. Like, I was watching it going, okay, they're, you know, I guess, yes, traditionally they have to take care of this person, and they're going to, and they're not... they're not warmongers. They're the village that are trying to survive. But to me, when, you know, they let this farmer and the two kids go, and there's that sequence with the little kids skipping down the rocks, like beautifully dancing across the rocks, and they're playing that I know music. It was just already like, here comes terror. Here it comes. He's running. He's pure evil. He's a devil child, and he's running down and beautifully, hauntingly skipping down these rocks to go tell the Taliban to kill. You know, and so I was so just like, I felt like, ugh, I don't know. It didn't, I didn't feel like I got to know anyone in that village. I know there's a kid that takes them in,
right,
and there's stuff, but it was so late in the movie that I was just sort of like, okay, well now I guess you're showing this side of it, but I didn't get, you know, it's like all the backstory and the lead up that we got at the beginning of the movie with all those guys and their wives and girlfriends and that story. And then, you know, you're just leaving there going, well, they're all dead. And these are all widows of these guys. And, right. Why? You know, Why watch this?
There's this amazing moment where you think they're going to get rescued, and they're not. To me, there was so much just pointless destruction of life, and against an enemy that turns out to be maybe even more compassionate in a lot of ways than American soldiers would have been under similar circumstances, except for the fact that they don't, you know, kill the goat herds originally, whatever. I think despite itself, it winds up being an anti-war movie, even if it was made in a totally gung-ho USA kind of mind space. I mean, yeah. Peter Berg, I think, definitely has kind of a boner for military might, you know.
Yes.
If you look at, you know, Battleship, if you look at the castle.
He is a testosterone director.
Yeah.
Very bad things.
Yeah.
Very bad things.
I mean, it kind of has the same vibe going through
Friday Night Lights.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, and so, you know, I feel like I have a valid read on it, which may have nothing to do with what he intended.
Right.
If I were interviewing him, he might say completely that was not at all his intention.
Apparently there was a Q&A with the real guy, the real lone survivor guy, and they said, if you could have done it again, would you have? And he said, yes, but I would have killed the goat herder.
Well,
and you're like, ugh, ew.
Yeah.
Then you, sir, I don't want to watch it. I don't care about you in a movie.
Unfortunately, these are the choices that war presents, which, again, is why I think this is an anti-war movie, because you are forced to make these decisions where you either commit an act of brutality or invite brutality upon yourself.
Right.
I think there are some complicating... This is a complicated movie to talk about, because exactly what you said, you know, it's first of all, it's a true story.
Right.
So unless you're going to fictionalize it greatly, this is what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Men whose jobs it is to not only kill, but to be the best at killing within the organization that kills. And in order to become that team of people, must indulge and be a part of the culture of, you know, we are badasses, we are strong men, we are monsters, we are coming to get you, you cannot stop us, we are gods. They must be that way if they're going to succeed. And so I think that's a fascinating group of people to make a movie about, just inherently. I think, you know, microcultures within other cultures are interesting to look at. And so the SEALs are, by that definition, you know, sort of always movie ready, because normal human beings don't know what that's like to be in that situation, to be among that mindset of, you know, We are basically superheroes. We're as close to superheroes as you're going to get in the real world. Mm-hmm. And so then what you have within this context of almost actual superheroes is the idea that, oh, wait, real life is still here. And you're going to be presented with a terrible, unwinnable situation. You must kill or be killed. You didn't volunteer... I mean, you did volunteer to be a Navy SEAL, but I mean, you didn't create this war. You're just the machine. You're just part of the machine. And so here you are in this war, and you've got to do something. And the thing you've got to do is kill people, or else you're going to be killed. And by making the choice not to kill, they were all killed, except for this one guy. Mm-hmm. So I think that's an inherently interesting film premise. Given that it's Peter Berg directing it, you're gonna get that very old-fashioned war movie quality. And I love watching old war movies on TCM, kind of for this reason.
Because of no moral ambiguity?
Because there's no moral ambiguity at all. In those old movies, the USA is right, and the enemy has to die. What's the Zero Hour? Not Zero Hour. What's the World War II
Destination
movie?
Destination Tokyo?
Yeah, where they actually say,
Japs don't love their women the way we do.
Yes.
That is an Cary Grant says that's that an actual
Destination
line.
Oh, boy.
That's an actual line in that movie. And so, you know, you can't go there really today, but Peter Berg goes there more than anyone. Mm. He is, like, kind of the current reigning king of the guy movie that makes no apologies for anything.
Unless you're making Act of Valor, which is the completely unabashed.
Well, right. well, yeah, of course.
And so, on that level, I liked this. I was into it. I was excited by the, you know, action of it, and very, you know, upset and traumatized by the battle sequences and sort of worried for the stunt people, and moved at the end when they showed the real guys.
Yeah.
It is unfortunately also, and here's the problem that I have, it is part of this post-Iraq war cinema of, well, really, we won.
Yeah.
I know we didn't win, but really we won. And here are the movies that tell you about how much we won. Mm. Because by even though everyone gets killed in this film except Mark Wahlberg, Lone Survivor is the title.
Right.
Yeah. The level of heroism that the movie depicts. Just by being in the war, you're a hero and you won. By some weird logic, you still somehow won. The tagline of the movie is based on real acts of courage. Their actual act of courage in
what
this film
courage
is
in that movie?
Is the Afghani people who
I
have
know.
The courage to save him
right.
against
yes.
the Taliban. And
these people, it was their mountain. It was like their
every person in the film is depicted as being heroic, except the Taliban people. And so it's this weird sort
it's
of like
how I won the war.
It's
thing,
this weird
yeah.
narrative now where really we won. We won Afghanistan, we won Iraq. And that is problematic. That's just deeply problematic. And I think film history will show this, because this isn't the last one we're gonna see.
No.
Right.
And as masterful as I think Zero Dark Thirty is, it's still also part of that narrative. And so,
but in Zero Dark Thirty, when spoiler alert, they kill Osama bin Laden. when that moment happens, the feeling you have is yay,
right?
Where yes. you're like, what did I learn from this? Who am I after this? This long shot. You know, on Jessica Chastain's face, right. where she's just like, right. I don't know who I am anymore. I don't know who I was before. I don't right. know anything anymore.
Yeah.
I have no purpose. And what was the purpose? Anyway, and it was all just in her face. When you're left with such feelings of dread and what is about all of this, and that's what makes Zero Dark Thirty such a superior film to
me. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And Captain Phillips is mm-hmm. another one where you're like, because you really get to know those Somali pirates and mm-hmm. Captain Phillips. And when that spoiler alert, Tom Hanks wins, it's like you. What makes Captain Phillips so great too is that you're so conflicted. You're not happy when it's. You're not leaving there going, yeah.
But again, I felt like I was able to leave this movie with my interpretation, and that I didn't have to bend over backwards to get it. I didn't. It's not like that. This movie doesn't end with a brass band and bunting. It ends with pictures of dead people.
Right.
You know. Bunting.
That I could. Bunting.
Bunting. There's a weirdly homoerotic vibe in this movie, as a lot
what
of.
What are you talking about?
The scene where they make Alexander Ludwig, like, twerk for them.
Oh, that's pretty sexy.
Yeah. That's pretty great. I also like the really strange cameo by Peter Berg in his own movie.
Yeah. Right.
He plays a Navy SEAL. It's like all these guys in their 20s. And then it's just a random shot of Peter Berg, like, cheering them on. I'm like, is this a Hitchcock thing? Why are you putting yourself in this
It's
movie?
A Hitchcock thing.
It's
and
more
it's,
an M. Night Shyamalan thing.
Yeah. It's a Hitchcock thing, and it's a it's
weird.
A boy I wish I was a Navy SEAL kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's like, during your years, you could have been in the military. You were, like, acting in Late for Dinner or whatever, yeah, Peter Berg. Come
exactly.
on. Anyway, so yeah, it's a problematic film, but I found it interesting, and I kind of came away with it thinking that it was Paths of Glory. So, you know, who knows? I liked Mark Wahlberg a lot in this. I thought he was good. I liked Ben Foster a lot.
Ben Foster's always great.
Yeah.
He's never given a bad performance, yeah. I don't think.
What else? Is that everything?
We have DVD picks, and we have letters, and then we're done. We've been doing this for 90 minutes.
Well, I know, but there were 80, but there have been a gajillion movies this week. Yeah. I was surprised we got through it this fast. My DVD pick this week is actually a streaming pick. It doesn't come out until DVD and until late January, but on Amazon Instant Video, you can get one of my top 10 films of the year, Concussion, directed by Stacey Passan, which I think I also named the best first film of the year on some poll or
fantastic
other.
Fantastic movie.
Amazing movie starring Robin Weigert as an unsatisfied housewife who becomes a high-class call girl in New York City. P.S. She's a lesbian. It's really great, and I very much recommend people check it out. It got a very minuscule DVD or theatrical release. It was also available on demand, and now it is streaming on Amazon.
Go.
I have to write because it's the holidays, and I've shared this movie with so many people. If you haven't seen The Ref,
yay!
Watch it. 94, Dennis Leary.
Yeah.
But really, it's all about Kevin Spacey and Judy Davis. Yes. Judy Davis. Judy Davis. and
Christine Baranski.
Christine Baranski and Glynis Johns. Just some of the best writing. Richard Legrevenis wrote it, and it's just, it's incredible dialogue. It's screamingly funny. It's pitch black.
Yeah.
It's raunchy. It's rotten. It's beautiful.
It really is.
It's one of my favorite scathing,
really great.
Scathing Christmas movies.
And Christmas is over and you can still totally enjoy yourself.
Absolutely.
Yes. The Ref.
I've been hanging onto these DVDs. I may have actually already talked about this once on the show, but I've been hanging onto these DVDs for a few months now.
For this week.
For this week. Because this week, I basically have the entire week off. And if I'm going to have a week off from movies and I'm going to watch movies, it's going to be either out at New Beverly or CineFamily or The Arrow seeing something old, or it's going to be on the couch with cocoa and all the leftover gingerbread that people did not eat entirely. I don't know why. Or grind into the floor like they did. And I'm going to watch The Way of the Dragon, The Big Boss, Fist of Fury, and Game of Death. I'm going to watch all four of them, all four Bruce Lee films. I'm so excited to do nothing and watch Bruce Lee movies.
All four of these are Bruce Lee movies. He made other ones as well.
Me, English, not always so communications.
Awesome. Okay, what's our letter?
Letter.
Or letters, whatever we got.
We have a letter.
A letter, okay.
From Frank Quinlan, David Alonso. Thank you for reading my top 10 movie list and top 10 Christmas list. And Dave correctly pointed out the best New Year's movie is The Poseidon Adventure.
Mm-hmm.
That is true. I saw it for the 40-somethingth time last
night.
Better
than Gary Marshall's New Year's Eve. Because I think that's just heartwarming.
It's close.
They all come together.
I understand how you can, you know, put them in the same category.
New Year's Eve means so much to people.
Yes. Yeah, it really does.
He says, although I will still take Sunset Boulevard and After the Thin Man.
Fair enough.
You've asked people to submit their bottom 10 movies list. I really have only one. The Other Sister.
Oh, speaking of Gary Marshall.
A movie where Gary Marshall tries to do for the, are we allowed to say mentally retarded? He says mentally retarded in his letter.
I can't keep up anymore.
What he did for prostitutes in Pretty Woman. In all seriousness,
with the movie that bad, I don't think that's an offense to any mentally disabled person. It's just offensive. It's offensive to all human beings.
Equal opportunity.
In all seriousness, why do studios let him make more movies? A gentleman I was dating at the time rented The Other Sister and then got mad at me for laughing at the wrong times.
Dump that idiot.
Dump that person.
Dump that open letter reading. Stupid person.
Poor Juliette Lewis, but she did redeem herself by being a judge on RuPaul's Drag Race and doing a spot-on Jiggly Caliente impression. Dishonorable mention, Forrest Gump.
Oh. Yes, amen. Worst movie ever.
Love you guys. Thank you for the podcast. Frank in Indianapolis.
And thank you, Frank. For the tip you added on when you purchased a White Christmas commentary.
We love you and your money.
That was very generous.
You know what? Howard Stern got Juliette Lewis to sort of like do other sister stuff on the air once.
Really?
And again, another reason why she is the world's greatest Scientologist.
Definitely.
My personal favorite. If she's in a movie, even if I don't have to review it, I go out of my way to see it.
Yeah.
I am in love with her.
She's fantastic.
And I love her in the roller derby movie.
And she's fantastic in the roller derby movie.
Great in that movie.
Yeah. Whip it.
Whip
that's
it.
What it's called. Yeah.
So that's the letter.
But also, Gary Marshall's in the movie Soap Dish. Plays yes. a version of himself, and he says, "I like the words peppy and cheap." And I thought, nothing is more true about Gary Marshall than that.
I just watched that again this week. It is Soap Dish is streaming on Netflix.
Soap Dish is another great one.
Heaven,
it's
that
so
movie.
Wonderful.
It's like Clue in that you can see them trying to be fast and funny and frantic, and but it mostly works.
It works. It totally works. The whole thing is a musical without any music. I mean, it feels.
Are they workshop? One?
They should. I think they always have. I've heard, keep hearing about that.
And then I heard they were going to do a remake that was set on a novella, like the Spanish version.
Oh, how great.
Which would be genius.
That would be wonderful.
All right. This has been the final program of 2013.
Are we having other guests next week? Is that confirmed?
We have not figured out who they're going to be yet. But next week we're going to do the year in review because not much opens next weekend apart from Paranormal Activity. The Mexicans.
I think I'm going to go see Wrong Cops though.
Okay, good.
I've seen it. The Quentin Depew movie.
Yeah, that was
fantastic, phenomenal, weird, horrible, stupid.
Okay,
brilliant,
good.
Everything.
And I'll be talking
if you
about
like his other movies.
Like his other movies.
It's funnier than.
And I believe they have stolen a photograph of my torso for the poster.
And I'll be talking about Interior Leather Bar, which is opening in I think L.A. and New York. But anyway, most of next week's episode is going to be our year in review: best movies, worst movies, etc. So we hope to have some fun folks with us for that. But in the meantime, I want to thank our guests. This week, Drew Droege, who we adore.
Thanks for having me. This was so fun.
Where can people find you on the net?
I'm on the Twitter at Drew Droege, DrewDroege.
It's your last name that's really the problem.
It is the last name.
It's so difficult. You need a different one.
I know. People ask me all the time if I made it up. If like that's my stage name. I go, yeah, I made up Droege. Yeah, everybody. But because I think it's the alliterative thing about it. But yeah, it's usually spelled right because people have to look it up. It's one of those names that people really do look up. But it's always mispronounced.
Do you get guff from Clockwork Orange fans?
I do. Every now and then people are like, oh, like the Droogies. but Droge is such a slog. Drew Droge. It's like, oh gosh.
Droge.
Oh yeah.
Oh lordy.
Horrible.
Anyway, we wish you a happy, very happy 2014. We thank everybody who's been listening to the show. Our numbers are up again for no apparent reason,
which we're
thrilled about. So if you're telling people about the show or posting it or whatever it is you're doing, it's working. So keep it up. We still have some gorgeous XL and double XL linoleum knife t-shirts for any of you larger ladies or gents out there.
Turns out most of our listeners are petite.
Yes.
Oh,
we had no idea
this was a thing.
So, you know, another stereotype of podcast listeners shattered. anyway, we still have the linoleum knife t-shirts.
We have like two of one. We have two double. We have two like extra larges, and maybe three double XLs.
Okay, so we're down to the bottom.
Yeah, yeah. Right. I mean, we're going to order more. Yes. So if you're a tiny person, just
hang tight.
Be patient.
Eat a sandwich.
Yeah.
We will order. We'll be ordering more in January. But in the meantime, if you want to order one of those, or if you still want our White Christmas commentary, even though Christmas itself has passed.
Why would you want that now?
You never know.
There's another commentary coming within the week or so.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah, there is.
Okay.
Beginning of the year is new commentary. We're doing this every month.
Okay. For more.
Remember?
Yes.
That's the plan.
Right.
Making money.
Get off my back. For more information about that, drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Feel free to write us with your own best and worst films of 2013. We can share those on the show next week. Or any questions or comments or what have you. you know, as always, check out our friends out there. Check out ChristyLemire.com. Listen to the B-Movies podcast and The Lunch. I'm on What the Flick every week at the Young Turks Network on YouTube. You know, check out...
I'll be making personal appearances around Los Angeles this week at a variety of food establishments.
I'm auditioning for a lot of commercials this week, so wish check me
out,
luck, everybody.
Check out the Schmozno and the Game Night Guys and all the other folks that we tell you about every week. You can subscribe to this program on iTunes, and if you want to leave us a positive review, that would be great. It helps more people find the show on their homepage. You can stream us at thelounge.com or Stitcher Radio. Like our Facebook page, follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, visit our website at linoleum-knife.com, and one of our resolutions for 2014 is more updating of our website.
No. We took the last couple weeks of the year off because of Christmas time fun and
things.
Yeah,
but I was slacking even before
that. Well, you were busy. I was doing my best to keep up the end of...
We promise more of
I
that.
I have notes for both of you.
Content.
Exactly. We're going to feed the beast more. Anyway, Happy New Year, and we'll catch you next time.
Kiss my foot or have an apple. Goodbye.